you can dance. For inspiration.
Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Into the Groove by Madonna, which hit number one on this day in 1985. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And Anthony McCarthy.
And welcome, everyone. As I said earlier, this article that we read by Dr. Hamid Debashi, one of our guests today, really raised a lot of questions. I was reading the article. Several things struck me. One was that the philosophers and writers that Dr. Debashi mentioned in his piece, many of whom from different parts of the continent of Africa, some from South Asia, many from India, some Latin American, I would say that 80% or 85% perhaps of those philosophers I've never read. I didn't know. And really, it made harkened me back to a story that I shared with Ray Winbush, which was in a preparation for the show, which was a bunch of years back. There was a dinner at my house, and we were sitting around, and there was one guy who was there, was one of my oldest friends, who was a philosopher and a Marxist philosopher, and another friend of mine there, whose name was John Trudell, who is a Native American writer and poet. And performer, and my friend Michael said to John, "So, who's your favorite philosopher?" And when he asked the question, I expected a number of answers to come out of John's lips. But what came out, John looked at him and said, "Crazy Horse." And we all laughed for a minute, but then everybody stopped laughing, and we started talking about what that meant. And when as soon as I read this article, the first thing that popped in my head was that story that happened around my kitchen table. Because it says a lot about how we think about the world and what propositions we mean by truth, how you define truth, who defines who and what we are, what role philosophers play. We have this huge thing in America about public intellectuals, but for what ground do public intellectuals come from? And what do African philosophers, the African diaspora, the Indian philosophers, be they Muslim, Christian, or Hindu, Arab philosophers have to say to us? And we don't think about them in this country, nor do we teach them or wrestle with what they say in terms of who we are as a people. So we're going to try to do a little bit of that in the course of this hour. One of our guests is the man who got this all started in my mind, anyway, for this particular show, Dr. Hamid Debashi, who is the Hagop Kevorkian Professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University and authored the article we just talked about in Al Jazeera called Can Non-Europeans Think? And Dr. Hamid Debashi, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And Dr. Tseni Serakabarhan is in studio with us. He's professor of philosophy here at Morgan State University, author of Contested Memory, The Icons of the Occidental Tradition, along with many of the books we'll talk about in a moment as well. Good to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming here.
Good to be here.
And Dr. Desiree Melton is with us, associate professor of philosophy at Notre Dame of Maryland University, and her primary research includes a critical race theory, deliberative democracy, feminist philosophy, and Kierkegaard, speaking of European philosophers. And good to have you in the studio with us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And all of you can join us here at 410-319-8888. And Hamid Debashi, let me start with you and talk a bit about what it was about this article. I mean, what it was about the original letter about the philosopher Slavoj Žižek, that a piece was written to him and about him that made you write this piece and what you were saying.
Well, there has been a misunderstanding that my piece is in response to Professor Zabala, who is a European philosopher. But in fact, it is not. I've been thinking and writing about this issue for the last 30 years in various contexts in my books and in articles. I just used a paragraph that Professor Zabala had used in his article as an opening gambit, as a trope to hang my my argument. That piece had just been published in Al Jazeera, and since I wrote this piece for Al Jazeera, I thought of just hanging my argument around that piece. But the argument that I have put forward, which, as I said, has been preoccupying me for a number of years in my books and my essays, etc., is the manner in which a philosophical tradition comes to universal confidence. And in the latter part of the essay to which you're referring, I go actually to Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, and the way he begins to argue with Immanuel Kant. So strategically for me, it's very important that I place my argument between two European thinkers, Immanuel Kant and Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci is speaking from the subaltern position. And as you may know, I'm sure my colleagues know, Gramsci became subsequently exceedingly important for other philosophical traditions in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So my argument is not really targeted against anything. It's really a reflection for my colleagues on the manner in which a philosophical tradition outside European context comes to universal self-confidence.
And let me just take a couple of pieces here. And one of the things the quote you have on in one of your articles, Dr. Serik Berhan, Africa in a Changing World Inventory, the piece that you wrote. I love the proverb you started with because it says to me everything about what colonialism in the West does in terms of when it goes into developing, when it colonizes the world. It's a Turkish proverb, which I just, let me start with that and I'll throw this out to you and you can talk about it, okay? And the proverb you used was, you said, when the axe came into the forest, the tree said, the handle is one of us. I love that proverb. I'm going to use it forever now.
Okay.
So talk a bit about what that means in context of what we're talking about here.
The world we live in is a world that basically was formed by European conquest. This conquest gets started quite a while back, but starting from the 15th century, it's undertaken in earnest. And the discovery of America by Columbus, or his stumbling on America by Columbus, the Prince Henry the Navigator going around the Cape of, you know, down the coast of Africa. And so it's a process of, you know, globalization is not something that starts now. It's a process. Europe globalized itself. It spread itself thin all up, you know, it spread itself all over the globe, right? And as it does that, it, of course, you know, finds its way in through the handle, meaning, you know, finds its way in through various groups, ethnic groups, classes, castes that collaborate with it, assisted slavers, slave traders. And so in this project, it has to be kept in mind that, you know, Europe colonizes the world not only physically, but the physical conquest of the world presupposes a certain idea of what the world is, of what Europeans are, of what non-Europeans are, of what religion is and what it entitles to, it entitles you to. And in that way, then philosophy also, especially the philosophy of the Enlightenment, the idea that we have reason, we have the true religion, and we have heathen peoples that need to be civilized. And so conquest is not, it's not so much an evil or vicious undertaking, but it's a benevolent act. It's an act, it's basically spreading the gospel to the four corners, right? And here philosophy then, the philosophy of history, which then was, you know, Kant, Hegel, Marx, and others, the idea that, you know, what is happening is not merely the effect of violence or force, but something preordained, depending on who you look at. For Kant, it's the workings of divine providence. For Hegel, it's the workings of the dialectic. For Marx, it is how the historical... You see, for Marx, communism presupposes the globalization of capital so that it can be overthrown. Hence, then colonialism becomes a vehicle for that. And so there's a way in which philosophy then plays that role. Now, when I finished my PhD in 1988, the American Philosophical Association at the time, that was when it first recognized, 1988, the African philosophy as a specific sub-branch in the field of philosophy. Up to then, it was not something that had been recognized as such. And so now, When we then, African philosophers, philosophers of color, feminists, when we come into this field, then it's important to know that, I mean, we were trained in the tradition. We were trained in the Eurocentric tradition. So, you know, any attempt to think outside the box is an attempt at insurrection. It's an attempt at questioning. Mm-hmm. You know? And so what we write and what we teach and what we write, necessarily, if it's going to do anything original, it's necessarily, not by choice, but it's necessarily political, because it has to clear a space. Because European philosophy established itself by mapping out a certain idea of man, culture, religion that excludes the vast majority of the. So any attempt to do philosophy meaningfully, not as some kind of exotic pastime, but some real engagement, necessarily requires a political undermining on the level of theory of the established conceptions and ideas. And so, in this sense, African philosophy, Africana philosophy, necessarily is a combative kind of philosophy, philosophy that puts into question so as to clear space and then articulate a different possibility. Possibility then that arises out of the context of the lives and struggles of oppressed people.
So let me ask you, bring Desiree Milton, good to meet you. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you.
How does this affect the work that you do, let's say, in schools? You know what I'm saying? I mean, when you think about, I'm looking at the stuff that you focus on, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, why is this important? I mean, I understand it's important when we talk about in the realm of how we view ourselves as human beings, how we wrestle with the issues, the moral, ethical issues of humankind, having all that input. But it's missing in our universities.
Yes, and Professor Sarah Kirbahan said it perfectly. What we're doing is clearing a space. So the work that I do at Notre Dame is purposeful. I still have to teach the canon. So, of course, I'm going to teach Plato, and I'm going to teach Descartes and Kant, of course. But it has to be political. I'm coming at it from a different angle than they did. And it's not necessarily just that these are European philosophers. It's the kinds of concerns that they had. It's the kinds of issues that they thought deserved philosophical treatment. And often the kinds of things that they thought deserved philosophical treatment were not the kinds of things that Africans or African diaspora people or women thought were important. So what I do in the classroom is I make sure the students know the canon, because you have to be well-versed in it. But I pointedly include readings by the excluded ones, the women, the minorities, because to me philosophy has to be attentive to the world. It has to be real. So we're just not going to sit around and play with words. It's not going to be language games for us. It is going to be attentive to the fact that we have been excluded and that we have something valuable to say, and it should be a part of the philosophical canon anyway. So this is what I do in my classrooms. I introduce this material to the students, and I show them that it's relevant, and I show that a lot of what the underrepresented or excluded voices in philosophy, I help them see that a lot of it is a response to the European philosophers, the old dead white guys, right? Response to them. But we're also bringing something new to the field. So it's responsive, but it's also building on philosophy. And hopefully, at some point, these works will become a part of the philosophical canon. So they won't just be add-ons.
So in terms of the world we face, I just want to do some broad areas here a little bit for a moment before we come into more specifics. But there are people here, as I said, I never read before. So after reading Dr. Hamad Dabashi's piece, I kind of Googled every person in his piece and started pulling them out, ordering books, reading stuff online, trying to figure out what am I missing here? And one of the first people, because it was one of the first people on his list, was Henry Odera Oruka, who I had never heard of before, a Kenyan philosopher who has the sage philosophy. And so whoever wants to kind of grab this for a minute, whether it's you, Dr. Dabashi, or Dr. Sarah Alberhan wants to grab it, what this sage philosophy means. And the next part I wanted to wrestle with is, so what? How does it challenge where we are?
Yeah, first of all, I concur with most of what my colleagues say, that is the current condition of philosophy, which is really what we're talking about, is post-Enlightenment, post-Renaissance, that suddenly Renaissance begins to claim the Platonic tradition for itself and manufacture a narrative that suddenly Plato becomes the grandfather the great-grandfather of Hegel. One of the issues that we face, but this is a very late manufacturing of philosophical narrative, that Plato as a philosopher was translated into Syriac and Aramaic and Arabic and Persian long before it was translated into German and French and English and so forth. So if you look at Plato as a founding figure of European philosophy, he has had repercussions, not only Plato, Neoplatonism, Aristotelianism. He has had repercussions to the east of Greece that is usually not included in the narrative that begins in Parthenon and then comes to Europe, to Hegel. One of the issues that we need to ask is not in what we call Islamic philosophy or Arab philosophy or Indian philosophy as an afterthought for this narrative, but for us categorically to reconceptualize the kinds of historical narratives that we have, that we call philosophy, with capital P. And then there are other issues, as my colleague said, well, let's now add some women, let's add now some people of color, which in effect results in what Emmanuel Levinas said, the only philosophy is either in Greek or in Hebrew, the rest is dancing. So we lose because we have already been put in a place that we have to prove ourselves. But as the point in my argument is not to say, oh, what the Africans are, the African philosophers are saying, is to ask in what way African philosophy does not become just African philosophy, but it's philosophy. Or Asian philosophy is not Asian philosophy.
Right.
It's not businessized. But it has a universal claim to the idea of philosophy.
I don't know if I may beg to differ, sort of, or maybe put it differently. See, for me, philosophy is always particular. There is no universal philosophy. There's always the philosophy of the Europeans or the 19th century or the Greeks. Any philosophy that claims some kind of... Because see, philosophy always occurs within a horizon, a context, a history, a historicity. You know, Gramsci talks about the fact that the beginning of any inquiry need checking out traces, literature, traces of what has deposited over time without an inventory. And so philosophy is this inventory of a lived experience. Right now, if that is the case, then it cannot be merely, you know, it cannot be universal in the sense of it cannot lose its moorings, its connectedness with lived life. It has to be a reflection on that. And in this sense, see, African philosophy is not African in the sense that it's in a little corner, a peculiar, exotic little thing. No, it is, you know, the critical reflection on lived life that takes its point of departure from that which concerns Africans. And in this case, it is the fact that we are formerly colonized people, presently neo-colonized people who've internalized. And what's interesting is, if you look at what is known as contemporary African literature, people like Osman Sembene, Achebe, Ngugi, you find that all these narratives, these stories are talking about how we now have become the colonizers. Right now, they lay out for us that which needs to be questioned. And then the case for Africa would be to question. For African philosophy, to question this. Now, you're saying something about Oruka. Now, Oruka is an interesting person. He's a Kenyan philosopher, and his idea of sage philosophy is something that develops out of the originary discussion in African philosophy that originates, as you might know, as a reaction to Plácido Temple's book, Bantu Philosophy, right? And Plácido Temple comes up with this book as African philosophy, the worldviews of Africans, right now. And Oruka, while acceding to that, was not quite, because he wants to say it's not just merely worldviews, we have to find sages. And so African philosophy is the philosophy of sages right now. But what I find problematic in Oruka is, in a way, was something that you suggested in the question, you know, so what does it matter, right? And see, what's interesting is Oruka goes about the business of sage philosophy like in a very abstract way. Well, there's this sage, you know, and there's that sage. But if we look at, and we should, if we look at directives as intellectuals in the academia, if we look at directives from our own history, meaning if we look at the struggles for liberation that constituted, properly speaking, the recent history of Africa. Cabral, for example, talks about a return to the source. In any engagement, in any kind of revolutionary or anti-colonial engagement, you know, there's always the forces engaging are always concerned with the their history, and what to choose, what to take, what to leave behind, and this then becomes the moment of, you know, of returning to the appropriating from the heritage, instead of doing it abstractly as Oruka does, appropriating from the heritage those elements that then can push us forward, right?
So the question is, I mean, so if you take these thinkers from across the globe that most people in America do not know or want to wrestle with or have chosen not to wrestle with, what's the interaction we're missing? I mean, let me just take a step backwards. If people, if like my youngest daughter really wants to study philosophy, she's very interested in philosophy, which I think is a good thing. So, and she wants to wrestle with issues. Part of when we work in colleges and high schools with students who take philosophy is to have them wrestle with certain moral, ethical issues, issues of what truth means, issues of how you interpret society. And I'm going to come back to the Marx piece and colonialism in a minute. I have a question to ask about that. But that's what we do. So I was thinking, Dr. Desiree Melton, as you were speaking. So then, how does the inclusion of a broader discussion in who we are as human beings from philosophers from across the globe, and not just European philosophers, introducing the unknown to most Americans, how does it change the dialogue? How does it change the way our students will think? What does it add to it? What does it question?
No, I'm going to respond to what you said, I also want to respond to what Professor Krebehan said. And I agree. I think philosophy is always particular. The problem is that the philosophy that was done, that has been done, the philosophy that makes up the philosophical canon, presents itself as universal. But it's not universal. It's particular to the men who were doing philosophy at that time, particular to landed white men. Now, it was arrogant for them to think that anything that they were writing about was universal. But now we have this canon that everyone thinks is the universal experience, that the kinds of questions they were asking, the questions about morality and truth and what it means to be human, that their responses were, or their answers, their dialogue was somehow universal, spoke to some universal experience. It's just arrogant. And this is what the kind of philosophy that comes from Africa, that comes from Asia, that comes from women, the kind of philosophy that we are doing, the philosophy that I think is most often political, even if it's not, even if it doesn't present itself as political, it definitely probably has political undertones. It's because we realize that we're not universal. We are concerned about the particular. The kind of philosophy that we do is, but so we're not striving for a universal, I don't think. I don't think my work strives for it, and I don't think that the people that I read think that they are speaking to any universal experience. What they are saying is that our experiences are valuable, are real. They're about the lived human that we are, and we want to be added to the question, to the conversation. So that's what is going to happen in the classroom, I hope. Anyway, this is what I try to do. I don't present the old white guys as the universal. I say, here's what they had to say about these questions. And then we have some other responses to these questions. So let's look at this entire conversation and tease out why people had different responses and different questions. And they're coming from a different background. It's just that, again, the canon presents itself as universal, and it's not. It's very abstract.
Yeah, and so it is abstract. And one of the things that I've always been interested in, Dr. Stephen Vicchio is a philosopher over at Loyola, who's an old friend, and he's
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. I meant Notre Dame. Did I say Loyola?
Yes,
you
I
sure did.
Say Loyola. I meant Notre Dame. And we wrestled this many years back when he was on the show a long time ago to begin to talk about this, which is where no one can speak to a universality for everybody, the interaction over the last 500-600 years on the planet Earth, which you were describing as the when colonialism and capitalism erupted on the planet and took over the rest of the world, forced an interaction. And you've seen, let's say, just culturally speaking, that on the globe, you've got the power of the African American diasporic culture has had on the planet, has had on this culture, right? So interaction was forced to take place. that's been suppressed. But now that the interaction is not as suppressed and is opening up, how is that going to change us? What's it going to do to us? What's it going to make us wrestle with we're not wrestling with? And what I have to wrestle with is we have to take a break. My producer just said so. We'll be right back.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner.
On a way to break, Shout by Tears for Fears, number one on this day in 1985. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Aquarius by the Fifth Dimension. Ron Townsend of the Fifth Dimension passed away on this day in 2001.
Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner.
And Anthony McCarthy.
My friend Anthony McCarthy in studio on a Monday. We are wrestling with the issue that came up because of one of our guests today wrote a piece that was put forward on Facebook by our dear friend here, Dr. Raymond Winbush. And the piece was called Can Non-Europeans Think? By Dr. Hamid Dabashi, the Hagop Kevorkian Professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. We're also joined in studio by Dr. Tsene Serkaberhan, who is professor of philosophy here at Morgan State University, author of Contested Memory, Icons of the Occidental Tradition, and numerous other books, Horizon and the Discourse, Our Heritage, the Past and Present of African American and African Existence, and many more. And we're joined by Dr. Desiree Melton, associate professor of philosophy at Notre Dame of Maryland, and her primary research interests include critical race theory, deliberative democracy, feminist philosophy, and Kierkegaard. 410-319-8888. Before I jump back into what I said, let's open the phone to let our listeners jump in for a moment. And Stacey, you're on the air.
Oh, I didn't realize I was up that fast. You're up.
There you are.
Hi to my colleague, Dr. Melton.
Hello there, Stacey.
Stacey Peterson, this is then.
Yes, another Notre Dame person. My two cents on this is when you broaden the discussion and when you allow for diverse voices to come into the canons, what you're doing is you're legitimizing all experiences and all lived experiences. And then that causes a shift in the kind of conversations that we're having. And it's not just one group of, like you guys said, old white guys being the default as to what reality is, because there are so many divergent realities out there. So my two cents to the conversation.
So when we talk about that, I mean, what does it mean to have then? Two things that popped in my head at one time. One was, when I think of the numbers of women philosophers, they're low in terms
very
of numbers.
Low. Mm-hmm.
And when we went looking to say we need to find women of color philosophers to put on this program.
Even
to wrestle,
lower.
Even lower. And two of them are in Baltimore, which is really odd, that are teaching here in Baltimore. But so what is then the role of women in philosophy? And who are we missing there?
What is the role?
What's the role and who are we missing?
Like names?
Names, who, ideas?
Well, what you're missing is what Stacey Peterson just said. You're missing the other side, right? I mean, if you don't engage with what women philosophers, and that's women philosophers, what feminist philosophers are saying, if you're not engaging with that, if you're not engaging with what black philosophers are saying, then you will be under the impression that philosophy is abstract, is out of touch with real life, because a lot of what counts as, I think, traditional philosophy for the students, I mean for the students, when students come to class and they think they're going to, intro to philosophy class, what is this? I don't know. I think we're never going to find a right answer. There's not a right answer. And it's all about opinions, and everyone's opinion is just as good as someone else's opinion. And I have to, I have to get rid of those views because they're not right. But the reason why they have those, the reason why they think that's what philosophy is because a lot of philosophy is out of touch with lived experience. So if we read what feminist philosophers, women philosophers, black philosophers have to say, we will see that a lot of what they say is about lived experience. You'd be hard-pressed to find an underrepresented philosopher, a philosopher from an underrepresented group who just does abstract philosophy. You'd be hard-pressed. So if we introduce these marginalized voices into the classroom, then students will see that philosophy is relevant, it's real, it's living, and they will find themselves in the works that we're reading. They will hear their experiences discussed. They will see that philosophy is legitimate.
And that I mean.
But I think that's responsibility of philosophers. It's responsibility of philosophers to do that. We have got to assign these philosophers to be read. You can't just teach the old dead white guys. You can't do that anymore. It's irresponsible. And if we're going to change philosophy to make it more relevant, to make it more accessible, and I don't even just mean in the public intellectual kind of way, to make it more accessible in the classroom, then we must include these marginalized voices.
So I have a question. I've been observing and listening to all this, and I have very little, I just must admit, very little interest in this outside of those marginalized voices that you talk about. Because of my life experiences and my educational track did not include philosophy, or if it did in a very, very surface way.
When you study theology?
When I study theology and we study world religions and putting things in the context of how these beliefs came to be, yes, there was but it was different because it was in the context almost universally, it was in the context around faith. And so you just had to dig and search and push and grind against what was normal and expected and European, which was given to us, with your own, as Dr. Melton said, experience. And there was a great deal of a leap of faith and understanding why people did and these horrible things throughout the history of religion and so on and so on. But let me ask you, because I think I want to put it in a level that some of our listeners who are trying to listen and understand the complexities of all this, I think some of our listeners really just want to know something very simple about philosophy, like what is this critical race theory that you talk about that is of particular interest to you, and then how feminism and women's voices fit in to that, juxtaposed to this traditional dead white boys philosophy. Why is that important beyond this idea that marginal voices are just not heard? Are they not respected as well, or are they not? I guess that's what I would like to get to, some of that idea of why we've got to push so hard to ensure that these voices are heard outside of what we're teaching these students in the canon.
Well, why these voices aren't heard, I think, goes back to what it goes back to the history of colonization and expropriation and subordination and all this. If you're seen as less than human, if you're seen as the people who can be pushed off of land, who can be enslaved, then why would anyone listen to what you have to say? If you are, and the same thing goes for women philosophers, right? If you are not seen as a rational agent, you're incapable of rationality. You can't think. You're not even a moral agent because you don't even have the ability to be moral. Morality is not for you. It's for men. Then why would philosophy listen to what these people have to say? So critical theory, these two are kind of closely related, I think, critical race theory and feminist philosophy. It's hard to study feminist philosophy and not read some critical theories of race. And it's hard to read critical theories of race without reading a little bit of feminist, without coming to those. And this is how I came across critical race theory. I started out reading feminist philosophy. But critical theories of race is a very multidisciplinary bit of philosophy. It's has sociology in it, psychology, politics, philosophy. And what it does is says, look, there is a racial hierarchy, and racial discrimination has informed our social institutions, our political institutions. Let's examine that and see how it works, how it operates, and what we can do about it. And, of course, within that, that hierarchy, it's hard not to see gender hierarchy as well and how that operates. So when you include these voices, when you include that literature, you see the world for what it is. You don't think that it's universal. Well, at least you shouldn't you think shouldn't. That any longer. You should see that the kind of philosophy that's traditionally counted as philosophy is not universal. It was for a very particular kind of guy in a very particular kind of particular time, and it doesn't speak to a real experience. Not everyone's real experience, certainly a real experience, but not the universal experience. So including these voices, including these issues, these conversations, gives a fuller, richer, more real philosophical treatment to important issues.
Let me come, we haven't heard from Dr. Bashi for a minute, we'll come right back here. Dr. Bashi, go ahead.
Well, I think the conversation has gone into a number of extremely important directions, but not along the lines that we initially started. Let me just pick on the question. First of all, very quickly say that I completely concur with my colleague, Professor Sturker Bernhardt, that all philosophy is specific. I'm not after de-specifying philosophy. I'm after trying to figure out in what particular way European particular philosophy became universalized. And by asking this question, I'm the least interested in the so-called provincializing Europe and saying, oh, Europeans were just a bunch of good white males. These philosophers have produced some magnificent works of philosophy that we are the very alphabet of our critical thinking today is indebted to this philosophical tradition. So my position is not against European philosophy. I'm in many ways a product of European philosophy. But my question is to take the European philosophy as a laboratory of trying to find out what has happened in other kinds of philosophy. Take the question of women philosophers. Concern is...
Dr. Dabashi?
Hello?
Go ahead. We lost you for a moment.
The first philosopher who actually made money, lived off her work, was a woman. It was a French philosopher, Jacinto Pisano, and who wrote a book called The Book of the City of Ladies. But usually we read that book as an allegory in response to Plato's Republic. But the question is, if you put women philosophers from Jacinto Pisano down to Mary Wollstonecraft, to all the way to Hannah Arendt, Judith Butler, the rest of them, Sira bin Habib, what happens if we don't take these women philosophers as commentators on masculinist philosophy, but as constituting a world unto themselves, in dialogue and conversations with themselves, not to create a ghetto for women philosophers, but to see in what particular way they're philosophers. The same is with African philosophy. The same is with Latin American philosophy. So my question is not a critique of Eurocentrism. I mean, it is a very blasé question. Of course, Europeans are self-centric, so, you know, what's the next atrocity? The question is, take the specific example of how, and this is the point of referring to Gramsci in the middle of my essay, because this is the point that Gramsci picks on Immanuel Kant, and ask, why is it that in the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals, Gramsci asks, Kant can say, I should behave in a manner that my behavior is universal code of conduct. How can he, as a German, as a European, say such a thing? This is the question with which Gramsci starts and from which he concludes the manner in which a particularly cosmopolitan philosophical thinking takes shape. Now, as a person interested in colonial setting, in post-colonial critical thinking, I want to take that Gramscian insight and run with it in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, with minorities, with Native Americans, with Latino Americans, with women philosophers, and try to figure out the context in which these particular constellation of philosophy can reach a theoretical and philosophical universalization that is slightly different from the way we understand the so-called traditional philosophy.
So I don't want to neglect what you were about to say, Dr. Zerik Baharan.
Okay, no. My take is a little different. Gramsci, for example, in the Quaderni del Carcere, in his prison notebooks, talks about a certain conception that philosophy and history, he says, form a block, meaning that the way in which philosophy, for him, the philosophy of any era, is a certain history reflecting on itself, right? Now, if you look at the time we live in, we are in a post-colonial world. By the mid-20th century, by the end of the 1994, South African apartheid was finished. Colonialism basically had ended, formal colonialism. So just as the end of the 19th century establishes the complete dismemberment of Africa, the end of the 20th century brings about formal independence. Now, what's interesting is this. This independence was brought about by force of arms, right? By force of arms. And when I say that, I don't know if people understand, but it was nothing written in the heavens or in stone. These countries became independent because they made life impossible for the colonizer, okay? But the presuppositions, the prejudices, the beliefs that sanctioned colonialism are still with us. So we are in a post-colonial world that is ruled by the legacy of the thought, the ideas, the conceptions that at one time were justified, now they're just there. They're not questioned. Now, in terms of your question, philosophy has to sort of create the situation in which the demise of imperialism is not merely the demise of its physical force, but the demise of its hubris, the demise of its arrogance, the demise of the legitimation that made it possible. Meaning, we're opening up a new world. At one time, we had a world dominated by Europe, a European world. Today, we have, in a way, multiple worlds. We have a pre-Columbian world. But not in the sense that we don't know each other anymore. No, we know each other now. We're all hybridized. The Native American, the African, the Asian, right? But within this hybridization, there's also some recognition of our difference, right? Right? And so, but for that to happen, the univocal prejudices that justified European conquest have to be undone. What we've done thus far is defeated the colonizer on the level of physical force. that doesn't amount to much. And as Rousseau says, you know, force does not give sanction to its effects. You know, we have to find a way of showing that, you know, the very conquest was not legitimate. Now, then we open up a new possibility. At least that's how I see.
But how does that happen?
Through critique.
Through
critique.
What does Frederick Douglass say? Power. What did he say? Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and never will. So how would philosophy is not going to do that on its own. Philosophy, a field dominated by white men, most European or just white men, is not going to just open its doors. We have to force it to. So I think it's not just what happens in the classroom. It also happens, it's who gets published and who doesn't get published. Mm-hmm. Who gets included in the main program at the APA and who doesn't. It's not going to do it on its own. We have to force it to happen.
But if could I just add? But also, the APA is the establishment, right? We can also start differing journals.
The Radical Philosophy Review, the Caribbean Philosophy. Of course.
And what I'm suggesting is that we sort of undermine the legitimation of the world that has disappeared, but it's still with us. In other words, if we're going to change this situation today, right? In other words, we have to be able to, as Edward Said puts it, imagine the alternative. And how do we do that? We sweep away the rubbish that still endures, right? We try to think a different, world, right? Not to replace a Eurocentric world by an Afrocentric world or Islam. No, to replace a world. You know, Césaire talks about a universal that is the coming together of differing particulars, of all the particulars. And the cement that holds us together then would then be our dialogue and our recognition.
Well, I mean, Césaire, who you talked about, some people read some of that, he bridged the gap. I mean, he bridged the worlds in many ways.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of his idea of the universal as a coming together of particulars. It's not one universal that superimposes itself on everything, but that the collection of particulars, whereby you have particularity. And this,
so
what's interesting is this thing he says in his resignation from the French Communist Party, which was one of the most universalistic, and so saying what we are, Caribbeans, Africans, women, Native Americans, all these things have to, these particulars have to be, they cannot be expunged in the name of some larger universality.
So ideas have changed. I mean, how we put ideas out into the world has changed. We don't sit around a tree. We don't sit in a square changing ideas. They're changed by radio shows like this. They're changed by the social media. They're changed by film. They're changed by theater. They're changed by music and what's under the music. So that's why I'm really curious about what the next level of this conversation should be, is, which was all really inspired by Dr. Dabashi's article, maybe start thinking about all this, was then how is that applied? How does that become part of the universal conversation and takes a sense of its parts?
Well, the thing is, if I may interject here, the thing is,
go ahead.
In the United States, many of them are known. Many of them are part of my own course that I teach on postcolonial theory, African philosophy, Asian philosophy, Latin American philosophy. They're all taught in various contexts in various universities, women philosophers, etc. They're not completely unknown. You're correct that they're not part of the public conversation. And much of the reaction to my essay has been, oh, I didn't know this philosopher, I have to check him out. Whereas the point is not check out one philosopher. The point is to see in what particular way they can become not added as an appendage to the canon. On my campus in Columbia University, there is a major library that on the top of which is names of major philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, etc., are carved on a stone. And there used to be a tradition that our students from Barnard College would go and hang a curtain over it with the names of female philosophers. This is not really a kind of political correctness, more let's add some women, some Africans, and some Asians, etc. The question is not political, though there is a profound political aspect to it. The question is between the relation between knowledge and power. it was particular authority, certain philosophical tradition with a specific history, very recent history, suddenly becomes a universal measure that enables Heidegger to say philosophy is only performed either in Greek or in German. Other languages, including English, by the way, are wasting their time. Or Immanuel Levinas to say the only thing that matters is Hebrew and Greek. The rest is just dancing, I'm quoting him. So, again, pointing these things out is not to name them, like the famous passage in Immanuel Kant's Observation Concerning the Sublime and the Beautiful, in which he says that so-and-so said something that might be considered true, but the man who said it was top-to-toe black, I'm quoting almost verbatim, a clear indication that what he said was stupid. The point of the argument is not to catch this philosopher as red-handed in the racism. Of course they were racist, but attending to the racism is a distraction. We have to go after Immanuel Kant to see why is it that he goes out of his way to exclude the overwhelming majority of humanity. When he says the Orient, for him, for Immanuel Kant, the Orient is the east of Danube River, all the way around the globe, including the United States, to the Western English Channel. This is the Orient for Immanuel Kant. The only thing that matters and is philosophical and reasonable and rational are in his own immediate neighborhood. If we are distracted by that kind of racism, we don't go to the main crust of the issue. And the main crust of the issue is, especially with the current globalized condition, that you have the Arab world, you have the European Eurozone crisis, you have the Occupy Wall Street, we are on the cusp of a new configuration of our imaginative geography. It is not just kicking the door open and asking other philosophers to be considered. The world that is changing, this is the final paragraph of my essay, the world is changing, and it's changing radically, and it's changing globally, not only in the Arab world, it's changing in Europe, it's changing in the United States. These changes will generate their own thinkers, their own philosophers, their own poets. It is that condition that we need to pay attention to.
So,
yes, the condition of post-coloniality, I argue in my recent book on the Arab Spring, that condition, that is the mode of knowledge production that we have had over the last 200 years, in my estimation, is coming to an end. And we are on the cusp of new manners of understanding where we are.
So that, unfortunately, because you said something really fascinating, which we could pick up on, is the last word for this evening, which we will come back to. I think it'll be a great point to pick up on a conversation for our next conversation. And Dr. Hamad Dabashi, I want to thank you so much for writing the article and getting this all started, at least on my program. I appreciate you being part of the show today.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to meet our other guests here today who I've never met before, Dr. Sene Sarah Aberhan from Morgan State University. We will be linking to all your articles and books on our webpage. It's good to have you with us in the studio. Dr. Desiree Melton, lovely to meet you as well, and we'll be doing the same for your work on our webpage.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Fascinating.
Anthony McCarthy, thank you so much.
Always great to be
good
here.
Good to have
Mark.
You in the studio, brother. Always good to have you here.
I love our Mondays together.
I do too. Taking a very brief break, coming right back. And on the way there, we're going to give you Alone Again or By Love. Arthur Lee of Love called himself the first black hippie. And he left us, passed away on this day in 2006.
And you do just what you choose to do.